You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Texting privacy policy and terms and conditions posted at textplan.us. Texting enrolls for recurring automated text marketing messages. Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Individual results may vary. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You've lost so much weight. How'd you do it?
I got medical treatment for weight loss through Zelty and lost 50 pounds. I struggled for the longest time, but Zelty makes it easy and affordable to get weight loss treatment 100% online. Zelty providers can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications clinically shown to help people lose weight, like Wegovy, Zepbound, and others.
I've heard those medications can help you lose weight, but aren't they expensive?
Zelty can help get the medication covered by insurance, so it's as little as $0 a month.
What if you don't have insurance?
No problem. Zelty may be able to help you get other GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% off the price of name brand medications.
I'm ready to start losing weight. How do I get started with Zelty?
Just text.
Text SUNNY to 200-300 to get started today with Zelty and see if weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound are right for you. Don't wait. Text now for a link to your exclusive offer. Text SUNNY to 200-300. That's SUNNY to 200-300. SUNNY to 200-300.
This is the Dan Le Batard Show with the Stugatz Podcast.
Stu, how many baseball players could you do the I wouldn't know if they were sitting in this room? Is it like, for me, it's like the flip side. I would say, how many baseball players, if they were sitting in this room, you would recognize
would you
your
know?
Appearance?
Right.
I'd say it's probably like two dozen.
You would know John Peterson, right? If John Peterson strolled into this into the studio right now.
I could wake up next to Paul Goldschmidt. Wouldn't know it.
He's won an MVP.
I could wake up next to him. Would not know. I'd be like, who's this dude?
How many would we know? Lindor, we'd know him, right?
I would not know Francisco Lindor? No. I would not know him.
I guess I've been watching the Mets lately, so I would know him.
I wouldn't know. Right? I would know Scherzer because he has two different color eyes.
We know, right?
I know Verlander.
Yeah.
Aaron Judge is an easy one.
Stanton's an easy one.
Got those.
Big guys, yeah. Sure.
I don't know what Manny Machado looks like.
Oh, I know what Manny looks like.
I would know Kershaw.
Yeah,
I think Machado would walk in. You think it's Machado, but you're not certain it's Machado.
I would know Machado.
I would know Machado for sure.
Yeah. But Tatis, he would have to say I'm Manny Machado.
I would
right?
know Tatis. I would know Machado. I would probably know Juan Soto. I have a wealth of knowledge when it comes to the San Diego Padres, apparently.
Mm. Gambling again?
Mm. Yeah, I'm gambling again.
That's right.
We'd know Mike Trout at this point, right? I think so.
Bryce Harper, you'd
know? I would know Ohtani.
Why?
I would know. I would know Trout.
Right, that team sucks. They have two of the guys you would know, and they're so awful.
Oh, I saw another Tungsten O'Doyle stat last night on the Los Angeles Angels. I think Mike Trout hit another home run. Shohei Ohtani like struck out some number of players, and they lost 2-1 to the worst team in the American League. All right, here it is. The Angels just completed a 73-89 season, despite having arguably two of the best players to ever compete. Both Trout and Ohtani had incredible years. Ohtani had the best season ever by anyone. At the final game of the season was like many before it. Ohtani pitched 5 innings and allowed 1 run. Trout hit a 490-foot homer. The Angels lost to the worst team in the American League 3-2.
Trout's found his power lately.
Yeah, he has.
Well, the season's over now.
A little too late.
Yeah. No, but I'm saying he's found it to the degree that you could actually have the conversation about him catching some of the all-time greats.
Any one of you to name the Major League Baseball leader in batting average right now. I dare you.
Ooh, he's a Minnesota Twin.
National League, I know.
Really?
He's Jeff McNeil.
Yeah.
Right.
Who the hell is that guy?
Stu. He's a Met.
Atta yes. boy. He's a Met, right.
Yeah.
He's a second baseman for the Mets.
He leads Met again.
He leads Major League Baseball again.
Is there an Alvarez? Is there an Alvarez?
There's an Arias.
Oh, yeah. I knew it had an A. Minnesota? Yeah. Minnesota last name A. That's I feel like I get a half point.
I give you the full point on that.
Yeah. The only reason I know about him was because it was an Aaron Judge alert. They were like, well, I guess you could watch this guy get the batting title. Yeah. I was like, who the hell is that guy? I literally found this out yesterday. Didn't retain his name.
Would we know Freddie Freeman if he walked into the studio?
I wouldn't know a single reigning World Series champion.
Wow.
Yeah.
We'd know Pujols.
I wouldn't know Acuna. I wouldn't know Acuna.
Would you know Springer?
Springer Dinger, no. But once he told me
Altuve,
that he said,
though, we'd know.
Altuve,
if George Springer said, hey, I'm George Springer, I'd be like, oh, Springer Dinger. Springer and I'd Dinger, move on, right. Living the rest of my life.
Right. That's what you have to say. Yeah. Right.
I would know Jose Altuve. I might know Yordan Alvarez.
Pete Alonso?
How about Adam Wainwright?
Maybe. Maybe.
Still out here doing it.
Adam Wainwright? No. He's got one of those faces that is just.
Face blindness.
Yeah.
Right. They all look the same.
I could try to draw. If I tried to draw Adam Wainwright from memory, it would look the same as Matt Carpenter. Yes. It would look the same as Paul Goldschmidt. Yes. It would basically look the same as any white St. Louis Cardinal ever.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Matt Holliday.
Matt Holliday.
Yeah.
No, I could pick him out.
You could pick him out. It's oddly the jawline,
head.
Though.
It was his head.
Yeah.
John Mabry.
He had a bigger head.
He had like one of those Polanco heads.
How about Mookie Betts?
Yeah, I'd recognize Mookie Betts.
Yes.
Yeah, I'd recognize Mookie Betts.
Balding.
Bellinger, no.
I would not know.
Trey Turner, no.
I'm just looking at like
Justin Turner
leaders in statistical categories.
So am I.
And there's so many names where it's like, first off, there's a player named Whit Merrifield.
Don't know who that is.
I mean, that sounds like he
has money.
You made that name up.
Would you know Hosmer?
No.
No.
I would.
What if he was wearing a Royals uniform?
Only if he was wearing a Royals uniform and several teams removed at
him
this
and
point.
Salvador Perez.
I'm sorry to baseball fans for how actively and aggressively ignorant this show is about baseball.
Oh my God. I mean, Mike's first having a heart attack.
Stugatz, like some of the people.
Ask me to name some Portland Timbers by appearance. Yeah. I could do that for you.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Would you recognize Paul Goldschmidt if you woke up next to him?
I would, but only because
Freddie Freeman?
I would because I have.
Because it's happened.
You've woken up next to Paul Goldschmidt?
Scottsdale.
He was a sweet lover, and we had just a wild, wild night.
Lake Havasu.
We reconnected after he did a terrible interview with us when I demanded that because he apologized for being boring. He apologized, and I said, well, just make up a story about, like, you were chased by a bear, and he's like, I'm so sorry. I'm not creative like that, but I'm going to be a Hall of Famer, and I mash, and I'm going to be MVP, and I'm really great. And the best teams in baseball are really great. Like, I have watched way too much Marlins baseball this year because the skill level is crazy. It's just nuts. And your team is good, Stugatz, and 100 wins isn't quite good enough.
No.
Because the Braves are also great. But I wanted to talk to you guys about something that happened in sports yesterday. And people are jumping to a lot of conclusions. Draymond Green seems really unpleasant to work with. Draymond Green seems to have a fuel of fury that can help sharpen a champion. Both those things can be true. The thing burned out in Golden State when it was Kevin Durant and Draymond Green. Draymond Green, everyone has said, you just got to get used to. He's going to be screaming at everybody. Andre Iguodala on our network is saying he's not here for any Jordan Poole slanders. People are looking at the three-point contest in Tokyo, making something of Clay's words that he and Steph beat Jordan Poole. Kept him humble, that Jordan Poole needs some humbling. But he doesn't need some humbling. He wants some of the same things the old guys on that team want, and he's also great. And Draymond Green inside of that locker room is old guard. And Jordan Poole's got his money, right? Like, they've got to decide here between Jordan Poole, between Clay, between Draymond on who they're going to give the money on that team, and now they're getting into a fight. I don't know what's going on for real there, but they're getting into a fight on the court, chest to chest, and I don't know if it's that moment of emotion or if we're reaching the point where Draymond Green, who's been buddy-buddy with LeBron, and he's doing a lot of publicity, it seems like, for all LeBron things. I don't know where Draymond's career is going to end up. I do know that Draymond thinks he's the furnace at the center of that team, and I don't think he's wrong.
Oh, I'm totally with Draymond Green. Like, I think Draymond Green is the centerpiece of that team. He gives them the toughness, the defense, all the intangible stuff that you love and that team probably needs because of Steph Curry and Klay Thompson. They're not guys who are going to do that. He does the little things, Dan, and he's very important to that team. Well, they are better without him. They don't need another Jordan Poole, another Steph Curry. They do need a Draymond Green.
I disagree. They needed Wiggins and Poole to win at the end. Poole struggled
in the finals.
No, but Poole did have some big games in the postseason. Yeah, he did.
They've got to decide between all of those
Denver
guys.
Series, they certainly needed Poole.
Yeah.
Wiggins is somebody else, though, that also is about to cash in. And they can't pay all of them, even though they don't mind about the luxury tax. They're light years ahead of everybody. But let's identify the workplace conflict, because it's not really allowed in any other workplaces. It's not a normal part of doing business. Hey, we all have a coworker who just likes to scream at everybody. Not in this age, not in toxic workplace climate age. We know that that's a pressure cooker that is different than other workplaces. But what happens when, before the season has even started, there are reports that Draymond and Jordan Poole got into it at practice when Stugatz consistently, I've been telling you, for 30 years, we make too much of these sideline incidents and loving the soap opera thing because these people work in a different world than we do. And right. So workplace conflict is normal. Athletes get to ESPN and they don't understand why everyone's just not tougher. Like just because they get beat up and they got to do survival of the fittest shit, and they're not insecure about some of the same dumb shit that we in the vanity business are insecure about.
It could just be, you know, one of those moments in practice where Draymond Green is always going 1,000 miles per hour. Jordan Poole's not in the mood for it. No one's in the mood for it. And Draymond and Poole getting a little fight. It could be something as benign as that. That's what happens in professional sports.
You say it's what happens in professional sports, and so do I, but what if it's a champion and Draymond Green is one of the most polarizing people in all of sports, and Draymond Green has made himself vastly more famous and has a larger platform as he starts planning what his brand is going to be at the end of his career? And Draymond's got a bigger microphone, he's got a bigger ego, and outside of Dennis Rodman, no one in the history of the sport who does what Draymond Green does gets to be as famous as Draymond Green is, even though he's great at defense. There's no such thing. It's him and Rodman, and look at what Rodman had to do to get that kind of fame, and Draymond's like, nope, I'll do it my way. Draymond's a guy, statistically, there's nothing there. Nothing. Now, he might be a damn well unprecedented defensive player.
Yeah, but he's a Hall of Famer.
But we're not celebrating him. His fame is not because of that. Ben Wallace doesn't get that fame. His fame is because he's a big mouth, and his brand is good, and his ego is big, and he doesn't mind saying things no one else will say. And now Jordan Poole ran up against it, and Draymond, the way the reports are is that Draymond hit Jordan, not that Draymond faces disciplinary action, not Jordan Poole. Does it matter? Michael Jordan punched Steve Kerr in the face when they were teammates. Does it matter, any of it?
No.
I think it does, just because Draymond seems to only be able to do this one way. That's what I'm fascinated by, is that Draymond Green seems to think that after having been the 35th overall pick and having been mostly ignored until Steve Kerr sort of happened upon a lineup that worked for him, and then he established his career and he moved forward in his career in this one particular way, that he's only capable of doing it this one particular way. And we cannot act like Draymond Green acting this way hasn't had collateral damage. It cost them the 2016 championship. It cost them probably keeping Kevin Durant, depending on how you view how that situation played out. There has been some collateral damage as a result. But Golden State and Draymond Green continue to think that this is the only way that he can be the preserver of culture, and this is the only way for him individually to be successful as a basketball player.
They won a championship after Durant left, so I don't know how much that factors in. But, like, what are you saying? It affects the team how? Like, the Warriors aren't going to be good because Jordan Poole and Draymond Green?
What he said is he got suspended and they lost.
He's also helped them win a lot of games.
But, Scott, in one of the biggest upsets in the history of the sport, in a game 7 scenario where Draymond Green scored 32 points in the game, but he got ejected because he can't control it sometimes. He cost them a championship, period, by getting suspended.
I understand that, but he's also helped them win 4 championships. So, I mean...
Correct. Well, what I'm saying is that there is collateral damage here. You can't universally say that the way that Draymond Green goes about his business is universally good for the Warriors.
I'm not saying it's great.
It has been most of the time, but I do think there are times where he's come up against it, and they've got to figure some stuff out there.
Okay, I'm not saying it's great, but in terms of wins and losses this season... That little scuffle yesterday at practice is going to mean what in the grand scheme of things? Nothing.
Stugatz, you say, I don't know, but you say Durant left because they had something, and it was with Draymond, and Durant did leave. You say it might cost them nothing. It did cost them Durant, and I'm not saying it's going to cost them Poole. I'm interested in examining, and we'll get to Mike Schur in a second here because I'm interested in his opinion as well. I used to have this conversation with baseball closers who threw 100 miles an hour and their hand would be shaking after the game trying to drink water because of whatever. Whatever the adrenaline or amphetamines or whatever it is of having to go to this place. John Rocker talked about it. Go to this place where it was furious and angry to go get the energy to throw 100 miles an hour. Draymond seems to play from there, and I don't know if he can always control it as I'm watching his Hulu special where he does deep dives on the mechanics of his mind and does like therapy sessions because he's interested in being interesting far beyond basketball, but I don't think he's got total control of this thing. And I do think he thinks it serves him so he doesn't have to put it in check because Durant's gone. And Jordan Poole, if you don't want to be here, you could leave too. I got Steph and Clay. We've won championships. We don't need any of you. I can understand why he
is would wrong to view it that way. Well, Durant left. We got Wiggins and Poole, and we still won a title.
At every turn, his MO has been reinforced.
Yes,
except in
won a title before Durant.
No, but I'd stop you here. At every turn, it's being reinforced. But now there's money, and four guys want it. True. And they can't give it to everybody.
One of them is 9 years younger.
And now you get into the cutthroat parts of the business. Let's see if Golden State values Draymond the way you think they should, the way Draymond thinks they should, as he fights with Jordan Poole. Jordan Poole wants that money.
Well, let's see if Steph values Draymond the way I think Steph does value Draymond.
Oh, but that's a cutthroat business, Stugatz. Like, he's the old guy, and the other guys are... Man, Wiggins, those guys are much younger.
I know. But Steph's done a lot of winning with Draymond Green by his side.
Is that the edge that Draymond keeps with now his offensive efficiency and just everything offensively just kind of gone down the tank? He's a liability out there on the offensive side. Is he using this edge to stay in the lineups?
This aging process, as we talk about Russell Wilson aging, Draymond Green playing that way, that physically, Stugatz, it'll age you at the end of the machine. They might not respect a champion with the money the way that champion expects to be respected. Mike Scherer, what do you think of all of this? A big nothing? This happens in the sports workplace or something? Draymond Green and Jordan Poole having a fight that might end with Draymond Green's discipline.
No, it's something. I was just enjoying the thought that maybe the Warriors would let Draymond go and then he would take his act to like the Orlando Magic or something. You know, like how much sadder that would be if he were out there screaming at refs and like getting in people's faces, but he's playing for the 20 and 48 Orlando Magic. Like that, I think the reason that he's always had the safety of the rest of the guys on his team being great. In order to like when it's Steph Curry and Durant and Klay Thompson holding you back and trying to calm you down, like it looks a lot better than if it's a bunch of randos.
You can't help but enjoy the idea of a guy becoming cartoonishly personality driven when he's Bo Outlaw surrounded by the greatest shooters you've ever seen. I'm the reason we win, or the guys who shoot better than anyone's ever imagined.
Man, we're forgetting series in which Draymond Green, playoff series, averaged 22.5 points a game, 12 rebounds, 7.5 assists,
he's
two steals.
And J.R. Smith, why we're forgetting him too.
Because
it's been a while.
It was a long time ago.
But Mikey had big games last year during that run. He did.
It's not that he's never. Of course he did. He's great. He's going to the Hall of Fame. It's not that he's not a good player. It's just that it's funny. His whole thing. He's weirdly like Tom Brady. His whole thing is there's a chip on his shoulder. He was overlooked. No one. He wasn't drafted in the lottery. He's a late round or a late pick. That's where he goes to. That's the wellspring whence he draws his fire and the fire in his belly. And it's not that is bad necessarily. It's just that I think Dan is right. It's like that team isn't what it has been without him. But also without him, it might have been something else that was also great because he has screwed up a lot of stuff for them. He kicked a guy in the penis, as Chris Whittingham would say, and got suspended from the finals. Like that's a really bad. That's a, excuse me.
Yeah, $5.
Yeah, $5.
Choked him up.
$10. $10.
And $15. Pay your money's worth.
$15.
This is a safe space.
Mm-hmm. And he also just punched one of his teammates in the face. Like, it doesn't matter if you're great. Like, when you do stuff like that, it will destroy the fabric of your team slowly over time. If I were Steph or Clay, wouldn't I be sick of it by now? That's the other thing. Aren't they like rolling their, like we're all in our mid-30s now. Like Really?
And they're so different than him. Just in, they seem so different from
temperament.
Him.
Yeah, but they love him.
Yeah, and you can love him.
But also, wouldn't they like? If he's been doing the same exact thing for like 12 years now, like he's in practice, it's preseason practice, and he's punching Jordan Poole in the face. I don't know. I think everyone thinks
it's necessary. I think that's why everyone still puts up with it. Is that I do think that like Steve Kerr, the organization, the star players sort of feel like they need that.
On October 5th in practice, like
why not? Yeah, set the tone. I mean. I mean, Jordan Poole walks in with a little swagger, thinking he's the reason they won a title last year. And Draymond's like, hey, we won before you, we'll win after you. Who cares?
That's a very conventional media spin that Clutch has put out there through one of their agents and Chris Haynes, which is, we talked about it some in the local hour with David Samson. For all that new media stuff, Draymond's playing some old media games right now.
Yes, he is. Wait, before we get to the stat of the day, Mike, as a world-renowned ethicist, what is the sports media and the public at large entitled to in the Brady-Giselle divorce lawyers being reported? Like, what are we entitled to? What shows the most grace? What can they expect from a public that's going to see the Shakespearean elements of this?
I mean, we're entitled to nothing, to know absolutely nothing about any of these people's personal lives, entitled being the key operative word here. The amount that we know is always far too much, because people unethically who are close to the situation in some regard or another end up leaking things to the media. Friends of celebrities leak things for money, which is about the least ethical thing you can do to a friend. And people who work in hospitals leak medical information to TMZ. I mean, this is where the rubber meets the road, ethically speaking, in terms of what the public has a right to know, even in a country that purports to have a free press, versus what we end up knowing. We're entitled to nothing. That's the simple answer. And yet we will undoubtedly learn horrifying details, not horrifying like bad treatment of anyone or anything, but simply things that we shouldn't know about the inner workings of a marriage. We will certainly learn stuff if we choose to by the time this is over. And that's awful. Like, it doesn't matter who these people are. They have a right to privacy, and their celebrity doesn't make them fair game, or it doesn't make it open season on their personal lives. This part always bums me out. Whenever people are going through something that has nothing to do with sports or the modeling industry, like you can have an active interest in either of these two people based on their careers. And that does not in any way mean that you get to know things that are happening behind closed doors in their lives. And and they have kids. I mean, it's just going to be awful. It's going to be terrible. I'm not really looking forward to the next wave of media stuff that happens around this circus.
And so what am I supposed to do as someone in the content business when this arrives with these elements and you've got the greatest winner ever, but he doesn't, the choice seems to be whatever it is, because you can't look at what is happening with their brands and what it is that both of them have said about their marriage and that she wants him home. And I can't help but want to comment on that, even though it makes me uncomfortable just because it ceases to be about them. And what an eternal, unbelievable thing to look at, the idea that most people listening to this would want to be Tom Brady at work forever.
Yeah, and I mean, add to that, you're talking about two of the most successful people ever, the most successful football player ever, perhaps you could say the most successful model ever. I'm not sure how you would necessarily calculate that. You're talking about two incredibly rich people, two incredibly famous people, two incredibly handsome people, people whose celebrity is like, it seems to extend backwards in time forever and feels like it will extend forward in time forever. And so when there's a problem in their lives, of course your instinct is to like think about it, to talk about it, investigate it, discuss it, but it doesn't have anything to do with anything. I mean, you could find an angle on this, right? You could say, okay, Tom Brady has been a guy who a couple times has thought about retiring clearly and has then tried to like pull an insane deal, rabbit out of a hat, where he fake retired, was given part of the Dolphins, went to the front office, came out of retirement, voided a contract. Like all of that stuff is fair game. to talk about because it's on the field and it has to do with his career. And adjacent to that and connected to that is the idea that maybe his wife in the past has talked about wanting him to come home sooner or end his career sooner. And so you're in this gray zone where there's an issue that's related to his on the field activities, but is also related to this other aspect of his personal life. And then the question is, where do you draw the line in terms of what's fair game to talk about? Who knows? I have no idea. I just know that I don't want to, it feels like one of those things where we are all speculating wildly. We're just guessing. We're pretending that we have any understanding of their marriage, which we definitely don't. And so I would prefer just to never talk about any aspect of anything other than his on the field performance or how handsome he is. Because I do enjoy talking about how handsome he is.
Time now for the stat of the day.
Stat of the day, stat of the day. It is your stat of the day. Stat of the day, stat of the day. It is your stat of the day. Stat of the day, stat of the day. It is your stat of the day. Stat of the day, stat of the day. It is your stat of the day.
Well, folks, as you know, I desperately want to be fired, and nothing I try has worked. So I have a new strategy. Let's talk soccer, baby. Here we go, specifically.
Oh, oh no.
It's a good day.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Erling
this
Haaland.
Is gonna this is going to backfire. This is going to backfire on you, Mike.
We had a blast talking soccer earlier.
Yeah. Surprise, no hockey. Yeah.
A hockey's coming, but right now we're going to talk about Erling Haaland. He was a 22-year-old, 6'4" tall Norwegian soccer monster who joined the Premier League this year, might end up shattering every record ever set. His dad was a soccer player. His mom was a Norwegian heptathlon champion. So this guy was essentially grown in a lab to dominate sports. He scored two more Champions League goals yesterday. He plays for Whittingham's favorite team, Manchester City, and he scored two more Champions League goals yesterday, which makes 28 goals in 22 Champions League games against the top competition in the world. He is like top 30 all time in Champions League scoring. By the time this Champions League is over, he could be top 20 all time. He's 22 years old. This is preposterous. It's hard to explain if you don't follow soccer how preposterous this is. It is roughly equivalent to a wide receiver having like 80 touchdown catches at age 22. This guy has the craziest stats. He has more goals in the Premier League this year than 14 teams. He has 3 hat tricks in 8 games, which is a record. The old record was 3 hat tricks in 48 games. But here is the actual stat of the day. It's not apples to apples because they played in different leagues, but Erling Haaland at 22 years old in all competitions that he's played in has 175 goals. At the same age, Cristiano Ronaldo had 50 and Messi had 44. He has more than 3 times as many goals at age 22 as Cristiano Ronaldo and almost 4 times as many as Leo Messi. Please fire me.
We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Give him a raise.
You have delighted us. You have titillated us. We will not fire you. Tomorrow, soccer stats and other stats with Mike Schur. Thank you, sir.
Can I tell you one more thing about this guy? Because I'm obsessed with him now. He has in the under 20 World Cup, he once scored 9 goals in 1 match. And in his first game ever at Dortmund in the Bundesliga,
undersold it.
He came on at halftime and he scored a hat trick in 23 minutes in his first game playing in the German league. He came on at halftime and had a hat trick 23 minutes later.
See you later, Mike.
Bye.
Hey everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
Don Levitard.
You keep mentioning Lou Harris and Lou Williams and Montrell Harris. You keep mentioning
Harold.
Excuse me,
Stugatz.
Nick, thank you for so much for being on with us. Really enjoy your work.
Oh, thanks for having me. Have a great day.
This is the Don Levitard Show with the Stugatz.
Presented by DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now and use code Dan for a special offer when you sign up. That's code Dan, only at DraftKings Sportsbook.
I'm pretty sure that I have this right, that the Sally Yates report, 319 pages, that chronicles just systemic abuse throughout women's soccer, that concentrates on three coaches, but really is an indictment of a whole lot of the power structure. I think all of this started with the reporting of Meg Lenihan a year ago, because I read a story from September 30th of 2021. I don't know how long before that she'd been working on this story for The Athletic, but I believe that's where all of this started. And Meg Lenihan joins us now from London. Meg, thank you. Explain to us how it is that you got involved with the work on this story and how long you've been doing the journalism around this story, because what you've done is pretty exhaustive, and you must feel as good as you can feel, given that this report seems to validate that there's a problem that badly needs fixing in women's soccer and beyond.
Yeah, I first got the call from the two players who wanted to go public with their own NWSL, and honestly, before that, WPS, the previous pro league, their experiences playing for former head coach Paul Riley. That first call came in, I want to say, around May. So I've been working on the story for about 6 months. It was not, I think that there were a number of other reports. Molly Hensley Clancy at the Washington Post has done a number of stories on other coaches, including the Washington Spirit, which we also did reporting around them. Chicago Red Stars, OL Reign. Again, to your point, it is not a one coach only or one team. There is a systemic problem, but really I think a lot of the major fallout came after my story at The Athletic, simply because that was kind of, I think, the worst of the worst. So,
well, go through for the audience, please, if you don't mind, the details that spawned, again, a 319-page report by a former United States Attorney General that it's appalling. There's no way of reading these words and not being really bothered by the abuses that these players had to endure from leadership figures, respected leadership figures.
Yeah, I mean, so for the story that I wrote a year ago, roughly, is it was really two players who played under head coach Paul Riley. One of them, Sinead Fairley, had experiences and alleged that Paul Riley had sexually coerced her on multiple occasions, also a teammate as well at the same time. And Mona Shim had an experience with Portland Thorns in 2015 where he began to target her and try to isolate her, film training sessions, restaurant, you know, out drinking. There's a number of cultural issues here. And so I think when you then go into the second half of this, where it is maybe a little bit less about individual player experiences and then into the institutional failures that are happening, that was another, honestly, very important part of the story that we really needed to tell at The Athletic, is that for all of the attempts that these two players made at reporting bad behavior, both Mona Shim at the time in 2015 to her club team, Portland, and the league itself, and then also in 2021 to then Commissioner Lisa Baird of the NWSL at trying to raise that there was information that was new, they were ignored. And so this is, I think, the bigger conversation that we're having around the NWSL, is that these reporting mechanisms did not work for about a decade. And that is what we have seen now with Sally Yates' report, is that there was a report about Paul Riley being a head coach in the NWSL every single year between 2014 and 2021 that should have raised a red flag for someone, and nothing ever happened until the story went public on September 30th, 2021.
How does that happen? How do so many people know and nothing gets done?
I mean, I think that's a big question that we're asking about human nature, honestly, at the moment. But one of the more logistical reasons is that there is both ignorance and then active malice at play here in terms of covering things up and setting things aside. And allowing coaches to leave and issuing press releases that wish them the best of luck on the way out the door. And so they're able to get hired in another place. But there's also this logistical thing of the club thinks that the league is going to be responsible. The league thinks that U.S. Soccer, which was for 7 years of the league, its actual manager, U.S. Soccer, was managing NWSL from 2013 until 2020. And then U.S. Soccer thinks Safe Sport might tackle things. So there's a lot of finger pointing. So there's elements of, again, just people not doing the right thing, but also then people thinking that other people are going to do the right thing, or it's not their responsibility to report it, or someone's going to take care of it, or it's an open secret. It's disappointing on honestly every single level of it.
And that's very much the institutional failure. I do want to ask about the systemic failure in terms of the relationship between male coaches and female players in the women's game, and also just in general in women's soccer. Why do you think this is so pervasive, that this isn't just the case of one bad coach? It seems like over the course of a year, it's like every NWSL team, I think bar one, changed their coach over the space of a year because a lot of things are being found out about a lot of coaches. What do you think is the systemic issue at play, both at professional level, and also the report gets into some issues at youth level as well?
Yeah, I mean, the youth part is such a heat. The behavior gets normalized at the youth level, whether it's the verbal abuse or boundaries getting lowered, right? Like that is something that so many players have spoken about in terms of coming in from the youth level and just thinking that this is normal. And so when it happens in the pro environment, they don't even think to report it. In the Sally Yates report, 70% of the Chicago Red Stars basically reported abusive behavior, and some of them didn't even realize it was abusive behavior. And that comes from the youth level. Now, one other part that I want to follow up on what you said is that male coaches, female players, but I think it actually goes beyond that. I think male coaches obviously have a track record here in a lot of this reporting, but it is not a gender thing. It's a power thing, in my opinion. And that might intersect with the gender element in some cases, and especially obviously in the sexual coercion parts of it, but it boils down to power imbalances and how people who have power use it, because there are instances where female coaches can abuse that power as well, 100%. So I think it kind of is going to force us to ask the question of, like, what is acceptable behavior between a coach and a player, and not just in women's soccer, not just in the NWSL, but I think from a sports perspective, right? Is yelling at a player productive and a good thing to do? And that's one of the things that the NWSL has been grappling with for over a year. And obviously it goes, there's a lot of stuff that's way worse than just verbal abuse, but that's going to be one of the things that comes out of this that could affect other sports. But fundamentally for me, it's about the power of it.
You've been asking yourself some of these questions for more than a year now. How many questions did the Sally Yates report answer for you?
I think a lot when it came to specifics, right? I think that was, you know, I've been asked a lot, like, was there anything surprising to you? And, you know, from a overall point of view, I think it just reaffirmed so much of the reporting. And obviously there was so much of our actual, the details of our reporting that got confirmed in that report, which I think was reassuring. But I just think that ultimately, there's so much kind of fundamental work that has to be done. And players are so aware that there's just the scope of the problem. It goes so far beyond this, you know, 319 page report, right? It's not limited to women's sports by any stretch. I mean, when I think about the stories that my male friends or my dad has said about the coaching environments that they have experienced in sports, verbal abuse is just 1,000% normalized compared to women's soccer.
But that's also, we're talking about sexual misconduct here, though, right? We can't, we shouldn't be conflating the two on toxic work environments. And we really should. I mean, we can have a conversation about whether coaches are helping when they're yelling at kids, and that yelling is normal and power imbalances are normal. But the sexual misconduct is the most problematic of what we're talking about here. And right. when you read the report giving you those details, and furthermore, the amount of dating and commonalities, power imbalances, all the things that happen when a young woman is learning from a coach who can abuse that power. What can you tell us about the problems in the mechanics of the pipeline that allows the coaches and authority figures to be predators?
Yeah, I mean, I think to your point, right, like this is where the power and the gender part comes in, because coaches who act as if they have control over women's bodies, right? Like with Paul Riley, so many players told me, okay, we're playing a sport, right? This is our jobs are dependent upon what our bodies can physically do. So it feels normal for a coach to say, I have to know what you're eating. I have to know how you're working out. I need to know your weight. And so that then is that kind of foundational step that then helps them lower boundaries, that enables other behavior, right? And it's in environments, like we've seen so many reports of coaches living in the same spaces as players, right? Which I think at least on some level has stopped, but it's that boundary issue where you push and you push and you push until finally it enables kind of that ultimate betrayal of the coach-player relationship. But that doesn't happen without that sort of hot and cold behavior of using the coaching relationship to say, hey, you're going to make the national team if I coach you, right? Your performance is going to be good. I need to know about your body. I need to be in charge of you. And then that's the grooming behavior that unlocks everything else.
Where else can you find these manipulations in the details of the reporting and the report where it becomes obvious that beyond dating pool stuff, that there are manipulations and the system is not only encouraging the manipulations in some ways, it's masking them by ignoring women who are saying, hey, isn't this wrong? And going to the proper protocols to tell people about it, and still ignored for years and years, making them yet more helpless and crushed under the system.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other really important contextual part for this too is when you think about when the NWSL was formed in 2013, three federations come together and say, hey, we're going to basically play for national team players. We'll pay for league functions, right? The name of the game was this league's survival. We had two previous women's professional leagues that had failed. So you have this landscape where players are grateful for a place to play, understandably. But what happens is that one of the really important things to understand is that this culture of silence was rewarded at every level. Because if you were the player that spoke out about a bad training environment or an abusive coach, you could be gone the next week, right? You have no job security in this place. And I think also the other part is like the boundaries are so much lower in women's soccer because of the lack of professionalism that Christy Holly is walking in as a volunteer coach. Rory Dames is walking in as an unpaid coach, right? They don't have the right coaching licenses. So you combine those two things again, and then this is where you end up in a space where you can have these relationships, right? Where if they're coming into the space, Christy Holly, especially, I think about everything that's described about his experience is that he comes in kind of as like almost like a friend to the players and then gets put into an authority position. So those boundaries are in a very different space than someone getting hired and vetted to come in as a head coach. So there's just so many layers to this. And again, like we're talking about a 319 page document, right? From the smallest details to the bigger systemic parts of it, it's just such a nuanced way of how this got built in a way that rewarded silence and complicity.
It's crazy to say, though, Meg, that a 319-page report from a former United States Attorney General is really not even tip of the iceberg. What you're saying is you're reading that report and you're like, yep, 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 obvious, yep, 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 just confirmation of yep, 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 we've known this is so for 10 years and now how do we fix it? Because what a mountain this is to fix all of it, because you're talking about the entire pipeline.
I mean, I think one of the parts that I have really tried to hold on to since September 30th, 2021 is that the NWSL or women's soccer in general, right? The heart and soul of it is the players. and what the NWSL players and everyone associated with it, like what we should be putting at the heart and center of the game is the players and their health and safety. And that's where we have to not necessarily burn the entire thing down, but try to take it down to the barest of bones that we can possibly get it and then rebuild the entire thing, right? And so there's both, yeah, maybe no surprises, right? But one of the big questions I think we've all been asking for the past year is, these are the people that built this in a way, those people in power that benefited them, that kept the league alive, that prioritized their financial success over the health and safety of the players. Are those the same people who are going to then be entrusted to lead from a board point of view in the NWSL, the league and the players out of this moment? And that's the accountability part of it, where Sally Yates really, you know, she does not have the power to say XYZ should be fired, right? The systemic recommendations basically say, NWSL, when you finish your own investigation, which is an independent investigation that has become a joint investigation with the NWSL Players Association, that's when you get to make decisions about the disciplinary angle. But now what we're seeing at this, you know, this past week is, the pressure is so on these people who have been in power and have built the system that it's just not a sustainable thing anymore. But to me, that was a question I asked November last year, is all of these people knew, and we knew that they knew. We didn't maybe know the depth of what, how, like 6-7 years of attempted reports, but how are these supposed to be the people who are trusted to lead anyone out of this moment?
And we're speaking to you ahead of USA England and the U.S. women's national team. Their leader, Megan Rapinoe, came out and called for the ouster of a couple of NWSL owners just before we started talking to you.
Her quotes are, Rory's been an asshole for the entire time that I've known him. Paul Riley is the same. I don't think Merritt Paulson is fit to be the owner in Portland. I don't think Arnhem is fit to be the owner in Chicago.
Right. So she's saying these things, and you're talking about sort of massive institutional change. I guess my question would be is, are we to presume that if there is a change in the ownership model and someone takes over in Portland, that these things won't happen again? Because one of the things we spoke to earlier, we talked to a former baseball executive earlier in the show about this issue, and we were sort of talking about how institutions protect themselves, and institutions, especially sporting ones, are generally sort of put in a position where they are going against their players, right? Usually in CBA negotiations, everything is a negotiation. I'll give you this, I'll take that. Is there an ownership model in which it is more benevolent towards players? There is an ownership model in Angel City, which is the Los Angeles team, where I think they're getting some of that right, but you just never know when institutions are first and foremost protecting themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point, right? Like, change is also very costly, both from a financial point of view, but also from that sort of, you know, it's painful to change the status quo. So I think there's that element, but I don't know if there's the traditional sports ownership model is like, I don't think that necessarily leads us out of this moment, but also at this point, is the NWSL going to like strip down 100% of the way, right? To say, okay, there's maybe some completely revolutionary way that we can do things, because that's a very big and tall ask. And I just don't necessarily see it happening, right? I think the expectations are so high within the women's soccer landscape in terms of, I mean, I hesitate to use the term, but it does feel like a moral purity judgment sort of thing, right? Of, can we trust this owner? And obviously, like, there is a reason for that right at the moment. But I mean, fundamentally, sports owners, like, you know, you can say all the right things, but at the end of the day, it's about your money, right? Is this a good investment? Is it a better reason to like spend your money in a good and responsible way because you're going to be rewarded for it in this space? Maybe, right? Like, if you can say, I'm a good owner to some extent, maybe you'll get more rewarded than the others. But, you know, I think just the way that we have built sports in this country, right? NWSL certainly reflects that model. And it's not necessarily going to be some sort of like magic bean solution for the NWSL, right? I just don't necessarily see that happening. But Angel City is interesting just because there are a lot of voices in the room. You have former players in the room, right? And there are also people there who honestly like don't know all that much about women's soccer and are both like horrified, but also don't know any better that it can't be done differently. And I think that's kind of been an encouraging thing, but it's not, you know, no team is going to be perfect ever. That's just not how it works. And there's no easy answer on that one.
Last question. She's a senior writer for The Athletic, covers the U.S. women's national team, the National Women's Soccer League. She hosts the weekly podcast full time with Meg Lenihan, and she has done some of the critical reporting around this for the last 2 years. But just so the audience understands the humanity in this, after 10 years of women being frustrated with what the way that the system works against them, can you explain the pressures that conspired one by one to make a woman feel helpless when she has been taken advantage of because everything about the system is working against her getting justice or even getting her voice heard in a way that feels satisfactory?
I mean, I think we've talked about some of them, the culture of silence, right? The complete lack of job security, the fact that coaches handle your contract, you can be traded at any moment. Let's also keep in mind that in 2013, the NWSL minimum salary was $6,000 for a season, right? So we're talking about that as well, the lack of financial security. There wasn't a union until a few years into the league, so there wasn't necessarily an institutional power that was looking out for the players. You have a lack of media coverage on a consistent basis as well that is not highlighting things that maybe people aren't building trust to be able to have that outside voice. And then again, players tried to report all of these behaviors, right? And one of the things that I think is so concerning to me is that there is this sense of like, well, 2015 was a different time. No, like all of this was unacceptable at this, like there's no need to say, hey, you know, like maybe by today's standards, we got this right or not. No, I'm sorry. No. No anonymous reporting mechanisms at a lot of these teams. They don't know who their HR person is. One like very minor detail that I think is actually really important is players' contracts are with the league, not the team. So you're trying to figure out, do you go to the league? Do you go to the team? There's just no clear path to figuring out who you need to tell. And then you have just this, again, a culture where all of the behaviors are normalized. So you're thinking, is it just me? Am I the only one seeing? Am I the only one experiencing it? So you are, I think, isolated. But then there's also an enormous cost to reporting if you're trying to go public. And we've seen that. The decision from Mana Shim and Sinead Farrelly to go public with the story in September and feel like the discussions that we had about what the public reaction is going to be, right? To have someone read what might be the worst day of your life. There's a cost to that. And there's a trauma to it as well. And so there's just so many different factors that
have played a role. It's crazy because you're not articulating a single incentive to come forward. Like there is not one bit of support behind the idea of coming forward and making any of this public to anyone.
The only reason, like I will say, the one theme that I think we have heard so much is, I don't want this happening to someone else. Every single player who has done this, it's been less about themselves or what they've experienced. It's, I don't want a teammate going through this. I don't want another future player going through this. I don't want the next generation going through this. And so there has been this bigger than me feeling across all of these different reports of how do I protect other people and how do I make sure this doesn't happen to someone else because I am afraid for them.
Meg, thank you for the reporting. It's important.
Thank you.
Hey, everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.